and ask that we bring Representative Mitch Greenlick and also Dr. Betterton to the stand. We're very happy to welcome you all here today. Very interesting subject, and I think it's a subject that most of us were almost totally unaware of until recently. So we are very happy to have you come and testify. Representative Greenlick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33, and I very much appreciate you holding a public hearing on this bill. I'm a reader of mysteries, and I ran across the issue of sodium azide first reading a mystery by J.A. Jantz, where sodium azide was the product of the murder, the product by which a murder was executed. In fact, two murders executed with a teaspoon of sodium azide and a cup of coffee. And I was intrigued with it in reading that book, and the afterword in the book, Ms. Jantz suggested that there might be a state legislator somewhere that would be interested in trying to deal with the question of so much loose sodium azide. We'll hear more about that in a second. And I sent her an email at the email address, and she introduced me to Professor Eric Betterton, who you'll be talking to soon. We visited in Tucson, and I became convinced that the issue of dealing with sodium azide was something that required a little statutory help from the legislature, and began working early in the interim with the auto recyclers to move forward with some solution. They had a little leadership problem, changed their leadership in the middle of the interim, and we ended up not getting a specific solution, although there still may be time for that. We can talk about that, if I may, again, after Professor Betterton talks. But it is clear we have a problem. It's also clear no state in the country has begun to deal with it, and once again, we can take some leadership. And I think what you'll find interesting thing is that the people in the industry are also very interested in seeing how we can work forward to solve this problem. So I'm very happy to be here. I think it's a somewhat complex issue, and I'm very happy to have an expert who knows about as much about this as anybody in the country to talk to you, rather than me doing my usual thing of talking about things I pretend to know something about, but then don't necessarily. So thank you very much for hearing us.
Thank you for coming. Doctor, will you give your name for the record?
For the record, my name is Eric Betterton. I'm a professor of atmospheric sciences at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona.
Thank you. Proceed.
Well, Mr. Chairman, committee members, I have prepared a short presentation here, a PowerPoint presentation. There are 15 slides here, in which I hope to, first of all, introduce you to what airbag inflators are, what sodium azide is, and then point out some of the problems associated with this accumulation of sodium azide in the environment. I would invite you to interrupt me as time goes on and to ask me questions. I'm here to provide information rather than provide a lecture, so please feel very free to interrupt me. So if I may, I'll open the first slide. I'm not quite sure how to point at the slide and face in the forward direction, but on the right-hand side there's a photograph of an airbag inflator. The bag has been cut away so that you can see the inflator in the middle of the steering column there. It looks like a tuna fish can. Little aluminum can, about the same size of a can of tuna, and I'll show you some more detailed pictures as time goes on. So, pardon? Yes, in fact, Representative Greenlick has a sample.
If you'd like to have a sample of that so you can see what it looks like at the committee, it would be useful for you.
Please, thank you.
So at the bottom of the slide, I point out that There is a review article, a peer-reviewed scientific article, which describes the environmental fate of sodium azide, which I wrote and is available on the web. I should warn you that it is a rather large file, 4 megabytes, but you're welcome to download it at your convenience. So let me start with airbags. They're composed of sensors and inflators, and then the bag itself. The job of the sensor is to detect the impact, and then once the impact is detected, it sends a 12-volt signal to an igniter squib, which is buried in the inflator itself. The sensor works on inertia. That mechanical device there is the easiest to see. For example, upon a collision, that's represented by the red arrow at the bottom right. The vehicle stops, that little roller keeps on rolling through its inertia and makes mechanical contact, electrical contact, and that sends a signal to the igniter squib. There are smaller electronic versions available as well, but I don't want to belabor the point. The signal goes to an inflator, and the job of the inflator is to inflate the airbag or airbags by a number of different means. A gas is generated somehow. In one family of inflators, sodium azide is the active ingredient, and I will get back and describe that in much more detail later on. In other inflators, there could be compressed ignitable gases like a mixture of hydrogen and oxygen. You can imagine if you put a match to that or electrical squib to that, it would go off, and they do. And the job is to go off instantaneously and inflate the bag and prevent you from hurting yourself on the steering column, for example. The inflator may just be a simple compressed gas, a non-toxic gas like argon or nitrogen. And again, it's compressed, and then when a signal is received, that compressed gas is released instantaneously. And there are inflators out there which are combinations of these. A two-stage inflator may contain both sodium azide and the compressed ignitable gas, for example. So there's this constant state of flux amongst the nature of these inflators. To begin with, in the early 90s, all inflators, as far as I can determine, used sodium azide as the active ingredient. Lately, the manufacturers of airbag inflators have been phasing out sodium azide in favor of the non-toxic compressed gas route. And I'll get to that a bit later. So, focusing on sodium azide then. The principle is that if you heat sodium azide, this white powder, to about 300 degrees centigrade, it will explosively, in inverted commas, decompose to generate hot nitrogen gas. Sodium azide is composed of sodium atoms and nitrogen atoms. And if you heat it up, they rearrange to generate nitrogen gas. And it's actually nitrogen gas that inflates the bag, not air nitrogen. And then that bag quickly deflates after the accident. It's done its job and is no longer needed. The sodium azide is normally blended with other ingredients to improve the burn characteristics, and then it's formed into discs like hockey pucks or into little pellets. And those discs or pellets are stacked in inflator modules. On the bottom right there, you see a driver side module like that aluminum can that was passed around. And on the left is a passenger side module, which is a lot larger. And we have a sample of one of those here. They also contain sodium azide either in the hockey puck form or in the granule form. They're much larger because the location of the passenger is not clearly defined. Ahead of the accident, the passenger could be leaning left or right and not constrained by having to hold a steering wheel. And also because the dashboard is further away from the passenger. So the sodium azide is packed into these hermetically sealed cans, and then also packed in there is that igniter squib, the thing with the red wire dangling out of it. And that entire unit is called an inflator. here is a photograph.
Can I just ask, you said it takes 300 degrees centigrade to trigger this. How's that developed?
That, Mr. Chairman, comes through the igniter. There's a chemical in there, a small amount of a rather exotic chemical. You feed 12 volts across it, which drives a little current through it. That small current is enough to make that chemical heat up, and in turn, it heats up the sodium azide.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Nolan.
Maybe you're going to get to this, and forgive me if I'm jumping ahead. Are there other industrial or commercial uses for sodium azide?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nolan, there are. Traditionally, azide has been used by the military as like a blasting cap in various munitions. In the past, it was examined as a broad-spectrum biocide or a pesticide. Many, many years ago, it was marketed under the name Smite, as in Smite Hit. And I've heard that there is an effort to sort of reinvestigate this market. But those are the major ones. It was made mainly rather exotic use by the military and other people manufacturing munitions and explosives.
Nasty looking gadget there.
So these are some photographs I've taken. The top left is the center part of a steering wheel before the airbag is deployed. And one beside that to the right is the backside of that inflator module steering wheel component. And you can see right in the center that round aluminum can with the yellow warning signs around it. This one has not been deployed. I got this from the place I take my car for servicing because I want to do some work on this. And then towards the far right is the passenger side inflator, which you've seen just circulated amongst you, much bigger. The bottom left, you can see an inflated bag. I inflated that with a big weather balloon. And it's up like that momentarily. It stops the driver from striking the steering wheel column, and then there are very big holes about the size of a quarter in the back of that bag. And the idea is the bag rapidly deflates after having done its job, so that the driver's vision is not obscured by the bag in front of his or her face. The azide free alternatives look something like this, a cylinder of compressed gas. That could be an inflammable gas like hydrogen mixed with air, and then that can be ignited to form water vapor and air, both hot, and that inflates the bag. Or it can be simply a compressed gas, an inert gas like argon, which is under high pressure, and then that pressure is released at a signal upon impact to inflate the bag. So it's very hard for me to obtain detailed information about what proportion of airbags today are inflated with this kind of azide-free alternatives. My understanding is that it is less than 50% of the current inflators contain azide. It may be as low as 30% now contain azide. But that begs the question, what's happened to all those inflators that have been put in vehicles up to now?
Is there marking on the container?
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware of. The markings tend to be those yellow labels which warn against inadvertent triggering of the bag with static electricity or putting electricity anywhere near them. Excuse me. This slide here, if I can make it operate, will show you how an airbag deploys. You'll see it go off in a flash instantaneously, and then the bag deflates pretty quickly, and you'll see a lot of dust as well. The dust is there to lubricate the bag mainly. It's also partly a byproduct of the decomposition products. You see how quickly it goes up. They say that it's like a shotgun going off, but you don't hear the shotgun going off because you're more concerned about other things like the front of your vehicle crumpling. If I can do this again. Quite impressive. They're very effective devices. So that dust is mainly talcum powder or cornstarch or something like that to lubricate the bag so that it can deploy as required. So, a brief background then on what sodium azide is. When pure, it is a white powder. The chemical formula is NaN3, sodium azide, containing sodium and nitrogen atoms. On the right, you can see a photograph I took. The white powder is clearly visible in the that glass jar there. It's normally packed in a metal can, the one on the left. The interesting thing about sodium azide, or one of the interesting things, is that it's very toxic, highly toxic, often compared to sodium cyanide in toxicity. And that's what got my attention, because when I was a graduate student, I worked with sodium azide to compare its properties to sodium cyanide, and I inadvertently gassed myself by mixing sodium azide with water and a dilute acid, and I thought my days were numbered. I survived, obviously, but it certainly got my attention. And then many years later, I read that sodium azide was the active ingredient in automobile airbag inflators, and I couldn't believe what I'd read. I thought it was a typo, and that's what got me interested in the environmental fate of sodium azide. So it's very soluble, very, very water soluble, 42% weight by volume, which means that if water gets onto sodium azide, it can get washed into rivers, into groundwater systems, into sewers or whatever. It also happens to react with water, and especially with acidified water, to release a toxic gas called hydrozoic acid. That hydrozoic acid contains the azide grouping. All you've done is replaced the sodium in NaN3 with H. HN3, that's hydrozoic acid. That's what I was exposed to. That's what knocked my socks off. If dry, it's stable indefinitely, which is a good property for an airbag inflator material, because you want it to go off whenever you have an accident, whether the accident be tomorrow or 10 years from now. You want a stable product in the inflator. It also has a very high nitrogen content, which means that you don't have to pack much into the can to get a big bag inflated like that. So these are very desirable properties for an inflator. And then, as I said, you heat it up too much, it rapidly decomposes. And you can blend it fairly readily with other ingredients like sodium nitrate or various metals to improve its burn characteristics. So I just wanted to emphasize the reaction with water. This has attracted some attention. If you add sodium azide to water, particularly acidified water, you get the hydrozoic acid gas formed, and I have written a peer-reviewed paper on this very subject. So it's as easy as what that cartoon suggests. This is what I did in graduate school, inadvertently. I didn't know the properties of sodium azide at the top. Add water to sodium azide. If it's acidified, you get this toxic gas evolved. And it doesn't smell, it doesn't have any color. The first symptom normally is bloodshot eyeballs. And so in my lab, in the fume hoods, I have a big mirror. And my students are instructed to keep an eye on their eyes. If they start to go bloodshot, it's time to quit and go out and have an early lunch or something like that. I'd like to briefly review the toxicity here, which I guess is the crunch. Why are we concerned about this material? There are different ways that one can measure toxicity or risk, and I show two here. One is called the relative risk comparison value, and this is a figure of merit that's published by the EPA, the US EPA. And it's supposed to show at what concentration, either in water or in the soil, a particular substance reaches some kind of a risk figure, risk to the environment, to people living around where spills may have occurred. And the point here is that on this figure of merit, sodium azide, the red columns, is about 10 times more toxic than sodium cyanide. You can tolerate, and on this particular comparison, 10 times as much sodium cyanide in water or in the soil than you can sodium azide. This is not the only figure of merit. This is not the only way to rank toxicity. There are straightforward toxicology studies, and I've listed some of the results there with poisons which you may have heard of. sodium azide or hydrozoic acid, it doesn't matter which it is right in the middle there. It's the tallest green column. The lethal dose for 50% kill of a rat population in laboratory studies is about a little over 40 milligrams per kilogram of body weight. By comparison, the same test on rats for sodium cyanide is a little over 10. So on this particular scale, it's saying that sodium cyanide is about four times as toxic as sodium azide. If you look at arsenic right beside sodium azide, well, it's about the same toxicity on this measure. And then right on the far right, I was able to pull out some data on long-term low-level doses given to primates. And you'll see that being exposed to very low levels of sodium azide resulted in the death of 5 out of 6 monkeys over a period of 2 to 4 months. So when I say that it's a very toxic substance, you get an idea of what I mean. It's comparable in toxicity to some of the poisons that you may have heard of before. Here's a figure showing my best estimate of what the problem we as a nation face when it comes to the amount of sodium azide out on the streets. I'd like to emphasize that it's very hard to get good solid data here, so I've been dredging around trying to get information from various sites and putting it together. Airbags were made mandatory in 1994, and before that Chrysler and Ford began to introduce them late 80s, early 90s, in anticipation of that federal mandate that all vehicles should have a driver-side airbag by 1994. After that, you can see that the number of airbags installed in vehicles just zoomed upwards incredibly. Today, we have on the order of 250 million or something airbags installed in cars. Now, not all those airbags contain sodium azide, as I've told you before, and I've guessed that maybe 50% in 2004 contained sodium azide. So with that guess, I multiplied a number of airbags by about 0.7 pounds. There's about 0.7 pounds of sodium azide in every vehicle that contains both a driver side and a passenger side inflator, and then came up with my best estimate on the order of 50 to 100 million pounds of sodium azide out on our streets right now. That is a lot of very hazardous material driving around the United States. On the previous slide, I mentioned that just a matchhead-sized piece of sodium azide will put you in hospital. It will make you unconscious within 5 minutes. A teaspoon would be fatal. So one vehicle then with 0.7 pounds of sodium azide in it represents on the order of about 300 lethal doses. That's, to my mind, pretty staggering when you have on the order of 50 to 100 million pounds of sodium azide on our streets. The sodium azide was introduced, as I mentioned here, in the late 90s, and then it's probably been phased out more recently. But the point is that in the past, going back 15 years or so, we've been putting sodium azide into cars, and those cars, being 15 years old or so, are now finding their way to junkyards. They're getting towards the end of their useful life, and this is my concern. What happens when this amount of material finds its way to our junkyards? It's very soluble. It will find its way into the groundwater if there's spills, for example. The possibility of environmental releases, large environmental releases, is not hypothetical. Back in 1996, on the I-15, just south of Salt Lake City, a 18-wheeler rolled over. It was carrying, 90 barrels of sodium azide. The sodium azide spilled, caught fire, just heated to higher than 300 degrees centigrade, and the resulting plume drifted over a small town called Mona, and there's about 700 people there. That entire town of 700 people, Mona, Utah, was evacuated because of this one spill. Closer to home in Phoenix, an airbag manufacturer was fined a substantial amount of money for illegally dumping glyphosate waste in a non-hazardous landfill. So it's not hypothetical. Large releases have occurred to the environment in the past. Now, my question, the question I posed after I learned that azide was in airbags, is what is the environmental fate? That is, azide is released somehow to the environment. An airbag inflator goes to a crusher inadvertently, for example. The white powder spills out on the ground. You have a lot of water there. Some crushers are, or shredders operate with water sprays. You have acid there because of battery acid. It's very easy for acidic water to mix with the azide. If it does, you can get azide released to the atmosphere where it's a hazard. It's a broad spectrum biocide, so if it gets into the geosphere, onto soils and so forth, it can kill plants and animals and bacteria. And then if it gets into the hydrosphere, being very soluble, it can find its way into waterways, into groundwater. In fact, there is an azide plume in Phoenix migrating down towards the groundwater. Again, this is not hypothetical. So, which gets me to
question.
The issue here. Yes, there's a question.
Thank you, sir. Have you, is part of your talk to talk about the stability of the form, of liquid or gaseous form of this material?
Mr. Chairman, Representative,
and thought, would you comment on that issue?
By stability, you mean the
likelihood of it breaking down into something less dangerous.
I can address that issue for you.
Thank you.
I can do that now. Let me go back a slide. I've just published a paper on the environmental degradation of hydrozoic acid in the atmosphere. It's possible that it could degrade by exposure to sunlight or by reaction with ozone, for example. And it appears from the work I did up at the National Center for Atmospheric Research 2 years ago, that the lifetime is on the order of days to weeks. So that if it were released for some reason, it would be possible for a plume to be blown downwind to a population center, for example. So it's not that it has a very short lifetime, like a few seconds. It's not that it's long lifetimes.
This has the potential then for being more dangerous than something like a chlorine plume or something like that.
Chlorine is very rapidly destroyed in the environment, you're correct. So from the point of view of lifetime of this toxic material, I would say yes. In the water, it does not degrade. It's stable in water. I have had sodium azide solutions in my lab for years. They're stable. And I have not yet published these studies, but I have run sodium azide solutions through soil columns, desert soil, because I live in the desert primarily, and it appears as though the sodium azide migrates completely through the soil. That is, it's not retained, it is conserved. So if there's a release in that kind of sandy soil, it can indeed make its way all the way through to the groundwater, hypothetically at least, theoretically. There's nothing to stop it migrating through the soil. When it comes to interaction with humic materials, organic materials, dead plants and stuff, well, there is some chemical reactivity there. So if it was released into soils that contain a lot of leaf litter or something like that, then perhaps it could be degraded there. But in degrading, it would be chemically reactive and probably destroy the biota there. It's a broad spectrum biocide.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So, end-of-life vehicle management, which gets me to my point. We have 15 years' worth of vehicles with sodium azide in them, and they're starting to come back to the junkyards now. How do we manage these vehicles as they come back? Estimates that I've got from the automobile recycling industry is that there's on the order of about 10 million vehicles come back to salvage yards throughout the country every year. 10 million a year is a lot of vehicles. There are about 12,000 of these facilities across the country and about 182 shredders across the country. The salvage industry tends to be operated by small business operators. They have perhaps a half a dozen to a dozen employees, but there are a lot of them around, and they employ on the order of 40,000 people. A large proportion of the vehicle, by weight, is already recycled. They do a terrific job. About 75% of the vehicle, by weight, is recycled. Mainly the heavy materials, as you can imagine, the iron, the copper, and the aluminum. And then there is a non-ferrous stream, which is fluff. It's plastics and padding that can't be recycled. The first stop for any vehicle would be a salvage facility. Some people call them junkyards. And the vehicle tends to stay there in storage for a while, and then it gets processed. Fluids are drained. It's partially disassembled. Usable parts can be stored on shelves and then resold later. So these photographs here are supposed to represent that occurring. So the first stop is the salvage facility. There is no regulation that I'm aware of that mandates that airbags be deployed upon receipt by the salvage facility. This is where I think a lot of good could be done if, first of all, the airbags inflated, because that will convert toxic azide into harmless nitrogen gas. It seems to me the obvious way to go. Convert a toxic material into a non-toxic material just by triggering the inflation. I make it sound simple. It's probably not that simple, but in principle, that's what it is. So, after the vehicle has been partially disassembled or totally disassembled, the last stop is to take the hulk to a crusher or a shredding operation. Those crushers or shredders can operate in a wet or a dry mode. A wet mode means there's a spray running to keep the dust down. And then that generates the ferrous and non-ferrous metal streams and the fluff, which no one can really deal with at the moment. It's a waste stream. Many of the airbag inflators, as far as I can determine, end up in this non-ferrous metal stream at about this stage. There's no law which mandates exactly how airbag inflators have to be handled, so I think they're handled individually by these 40,000 people that are working on these this industry across the nation. Now, it's quite amazing the kind of emails and telephone calls I get throughout the year. Late last year, I got a telephone call from a person running a secondary scrap metal facility business over in the Midwest, and he was buying scrap aluminum from these crushers and shredders, and he'd wound up with a stockpile of airbag inflators, and he wanted to know how to handle them. So I said, well, the best thing to do is to apply 12 volts across the terminals, and then you convert azide into nitrogen gas. And he said, well, you don't understand the problem. I have a stockpile of 40,000 of these inflators. How am I going to handle them, you know? And I said, I'll call you back. I didn't have an immediate solution to that. That's a lot of inflators stockpiled in one location. They are not undercover. They're open to the elements. They just happen to be there. So I have no solution for this guy as yet. The recycling industry is no great friend of airbag inflators, as far as I can determine. They do realize there's a problem here. There's a hazard to their workers, because you never know when one of these things is going to go off. And they'd rather not have to deal with them if possible. They, I think, view them in the same light as they do mercury switches and other non-recyclable materials. There are no international regulations that I can determine. ISO, the International Organization for Standards, does not seem to have an approved method for handling inflators. The Japanese Automobile Manufacturers Association years ago did have a voluntary recommended procedure, and that was to deploy the airbag upon receipt. They also wanted to have what they call a unified airbag expansion system. That meant that there'd be some kind of a regulation or unified wiring code, so that all automobile manufacturers would have a similar wiring under the hood, so to make it very easy for the recyclers to that simply sort of pop a button, hit the red button, and all the inflators would inflate at once. So you don't have to know what's in the inflators, you don't have to know where they are, whether they're in the head or whether they're in the side, or whether that'll go off, make it much easier, which I think is a reasonable solution for the future. It won't help now, but for the future I think it would be a very smart thing to do. And then they suggest that four vehicles which don't have this unified airbag expansion system, that the inflators be recovered and disposed of on a concentrated basis. I don't quite sure what they mean by that. When it comes to the U.S., it is not clear to me that the RCRA code applies here. The U.S. EPA doesn't seem to believe that it's a hazardous waste. New York State, they actually prohibit a sale of recycled airbags. New York State does. So this is a way of actually preventing recycling of airbags. It's not well received to recycle an airbag in general, and New York State's prevented the recycling of airbags. So that means that bags that you may think of could have been recycled can't be in New York State. And then their environmental quality division has some recommendations, best management practices. Remove the airbags and then store them, and then what you do with them after that is unclear. Let's just store them and keep them out of the bad weather. In Washington State, close to us, they have almost identical language. I presume one state copied the other's regulations. That is, remove the unused airbags and then store them until we figure out what to do with them. But there's nothing that mandates what to do with them. Insurance industry is not too happy about airbag recycling, if recycling is something that you thought of adopting because of liability issues. No one knows what the history of an airbag inflator is. It goes to the car, goes to the junkyard. Who knows what the history of that car was? Perhaps it was inundated with water in a flood or a hurricane, or went under a lake or something. If that airbag, a recycled airbag, fails to inflate when needed, then there could be a huge liability issue. The Automotive Occupant Restraints Council, an industry group, is also not particularly, in favor of recycling. They would prefer to see airbags replaced with new airbags. And then towards the end here, I mention the Maine Mercury Switch Recovery Act. This has got nothing to do with airbags, but it is a piece of legislation which you may find interesting to investigate. Maine has taken action about mercury switches that are used in many vehicles, that mercury is accumulating in the environment. And they introduced legislation which would make it the automobile manufacturer's responsibility to somehow bring back those mercury switches to a central location and then process them appropriately. Exactly how they persuade the manufacturers to do that, I'm not sure, but this may be a model that you may be interested in looking at. And so I hope I'm not overreaching myself here where I make a few suggestions. I'm not sort of a strong advocate for any of these. I just like to bring them up because I've been thinking about them over the years. One would be to adapt Maine's mercury switch regulations, provide some incentives perhaps to bring in airbags for the recycling yards to remove them and to send them back to manufacturers perhaps. It may be attractive to make it mandatory to deploy these airbags upon delivery. And as I mentioned before, you thereby convert toxic azide into harmless nitrogen gas immediately. And then it may be an advantage, in the future at least, to mandate this uniform wiring code so that even if airbags in the future do not contain any azide, at least it makes it easier for the recycling people to deploy them and thereby protect their people who would otherwise be reaching in there trying to take seats out of the vehicle or trying to take switches out of the dashboard or something like that. You never know when there could be an accident. And then there's always the question of costs. It takes a little bit more time, perhaps, to remove an airbag and failure. If the particular recycling facility doesn't do it now and a law comes in making it mandatory, they've got to take a little bit of extra time to remove it. So, and time is money, so perhaps there's costs associated with it. And I've mentioned that these recyclers tend to be small businesses. They have rather low margins and rather low annual revenues, so one must be sensitive to the imposition of any fees and impact it could have on them. And you, as I said, would need some kind of fee, I think. Maybe not, but you have to be sensitive at least to the extra time it would take to remove or deploy these airbags. And that concludes my remarks, and I'd be very happy to take any further questions.
Thank you very much. But we have a few questions.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'd just like to add a couple of brief comments to this. Sodium azide, there is some clinical experience dealing with sodium azide poisoning. It was at one time used as in medical laboratories to, since it's such a strong biocide, to kill everything in the laboratory. It has the uncomfortable characteristic of if somebody has sodium azide poisoning, they show up in the emergency room looking like they have cyanide poisoning. The problem is if you treated the cyanide poisoning, that will kill the patient. So it's that odd clinical presentation. The treatment is exactly the opposite as the treatment for cyanide poisoning, which is much more common and which what it looks like. We worry about
question.
How do you so the initial treatment, the initial diagnosis, how do you distinguish at the point that somebody comes into the emergency room for?
Well, if you're careful, you do it by history. You try and find out what it is that's brought that person there. I mean, if it's like in the mystery I was reading and somebody murdered them, you wouldn't find it out. But usually this, you try and find out where the exposure either to cyanide or, if you're thinking about it, the azide came. And that's probably the only way. The patient's probably unconscious and it makes it very hard. There's a bit of a literature on how to deal with it, and it's a very complicated clinical problem. The other characteristic is we're worried about Homeland Security, and Professor Betterton's pointed out that two of those little cans is enough explosive to take out a telephone exchange. You can imagine, you know, we're trying to keep fertilizer out of the hands of people who want to blow up buildings, but we have, in fact, a much more effective explosive here, and we don't, I mean, there are literally, this one place, 40,000 cans would be enough to take down the World Trade Center without having to fly an airplane into it. I mean, this is something that's just out there and easily available. I mean, I could go over a fence into a junkyard and probably get enough explosive to blow up the Capitol. I'm not recommending that on the record, but the fact is that potential is there. So we have, across a whole set of levels, a really major, potentially dangerous situation. Hydrozoic acid, in its gaseous form, he didn't mention, is basically about the same as sarin. It's you know, which we know was used in the Japanese subway sabotage. So, I mean, these are very dangerous problems, and we're just completely oblivious to it. What makes it so ironic is it's a product that's very easy to deal with. All you need to do, and when I talk to the auto recyclers, many of the good recyclers say, well, of course, we take the airbags out, we put them in a stand, we put 12 volts against them, we blow it. We have somebody who likes to do that. That's kind of fun to create those blowing airbags, and they say that's a matter of their routine practice in some of the places. So what we need to seek for, and what I propose here, unless we can figure it out between now and the middle of this session, is at least getting a task force of the people together. We need to find a way to do it feasibly. You'll hear something about fiscal impact. We need to get a brief task force together, come to some consensus about how to deal with this end-of-life problem. This is another end-of-life problem that Oregon can get into quickly. the end-of-life problem of the airbags, and essentially create at least the best practice that begins to move the industry into moving this in the right direction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize, I was testifying in another committee, so I got here a little late, but has there been any effort to deal with this at a federal level?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I'm not aware of any federal legislation that is on the books or proposed immediately, although I have been trying for several years to get something like that going. I've always been thwarted by other more important events like presidential elections and so forth, which have tended to distract Senator McCain's office, for example. So the people I've been speaking to most.
Thank you.
Representative Bloom.
Yes. It seems to me that this, what's the name of it?
Yes.
Sodium
azide.
It seems like a very dangerous, toxic poison. And then, do we have any luxury to wait another 2 years? To wait.
That's for me, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Lim. No, I think we need to find a way to deal with it now and get it moving. And I believe with the people that we're working with, we probably can, if you hold this bill, we probably can get a consensus on at least some things to do. I agree with you. I'm not comfortable simply creating a task force and waiting for the interim. And I will, after this hearing, and I expect you'll hear some more testimony, I will, after this hearing, work with folks. I do understand that there is a potential ISO standard being worked on that might be available soon. And we might produce a model that is ready for that when that standard gets in the meantime has a first step. But no, I think we can figure out how to do it, because I think we're all in this together, and there's no opposition to moving in this direction, I think. I don't think you may hear opposition to this bill, but not to figuring out how to deal with the problem.
Okay, Mr. Chair, follow-up questions. And you explained to us that some laws in New York and Washington, and could you explain to us again what the law is about and how they are doing it? And sometimes you mentioned it is not helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lim, there are no laws that mandate the deployment of the airbag upon receipt by the recycling facility. There is no law that I'm aware of in the United States. The laws that are there tend to be rather inconclusive. They are recommendations, for example, that the airbag inflator be removed from the vehicle, that they be stockpiled and then somehow disposed of, but it's never clear as to how it will be disposed of. It's not mandatory that they be removed, not mandatory that they be stockpiled or disposed of. In New York, there is a law which prohibits the resale of recycled airbags. And the reason I brought that point up is because many people say, well, we have these inflators in the vehicles, why don't we just recycle them, remove them, and then use them in another vehicle? And that's a reasonable option, except that there's so much opposition to it, both technical and from a legal point of view. Mm-hmm. And New York State, for example, makes it illegal to install a recycled airbag, mainly because of the liability issues. There are also technical issues. As I mentioned, the inflators have evolved over time. They used to be purely azide. Then it became these two-stage airbags. Then it became these so-called smart airbags. And Oldsmobile and Buick and Honda and whoever it is has a different kind of inflator. So there are so many inflators out there, it's almost impossible to take an airbag inflator from a 1994 Buick and put it into a 2000 Explorer, for example. Can't be done. there are both technical and legal and liability issues why recycling of airbag inflators won't work.
In fact, you can't even be sure you can take an airbag from a 98 Buick and put it in another 98 Buick. They're tuned specifically to the engine of the car, and there will be variants of the airbags within the same year of a single automobile. My understanding is there's only one recycler in the state that uses that feels safe in using recycled airbags. So almost none of them are reinstalled in cars, and the answer is so simple: inflate them. And that's all it takes.
So one more follow-up question. Do you know where these chemicals were made? Made in USA? Well, I read some materials here imported from other countries. And where are they coming from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lim, it's a mix. There is a company, or at least one company, in the United States that manufactured sodium azide, and it was also imported as well, for example, from Japan, from India as well, I believe. I don't know where the sodium azide comes from now. I don't know if it's all manufactured locally or if it's imported. I think it depends on the relative cost and the relative demand for sodium azide. The spill that I mentioned on the I-15 just south of Salt Lake City was imported material being shipped to an airbag manufacturer, and it happened to roll over just south of Salt Lake City.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, one question.
I'm sorry, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more question. You've talked about inflating them as the solution to the problem, because I think you certainly implied this, but I don't think you've said it yet. I take it from that comment that, or that suggestion, that the chemical reaction that occurs in the inflation process destroys all or very nearly all of the material that we're concerned about.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that's correct. The sodium azide is practically totally destroyed upon inflation. There is some evidence that there are trace amounts left in the dust, but they are trace amounts. It's nothing like what's in those hockey pucks or those granules.
Thank you.
Dr. Betterton, tell me a little bit about the cost involved. What is the deployment equipment? Highly specialized? Is it very expensive? Is it?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not an expert on this, but I can tell you what I've observed at my local Buick dealer, where I take my car in for a service. They know me through the newspapers and this interest I have. When they have to replace the center section of a steering wheel, for example, because the horn failed or something like that, they accumulate these inflators over a period of a week or two, and then they destroy them by deploying them. And it's very easy. They have a little plug, and they have a little battery. It's actually not a 12-volt battery. It's a 9-volt battery. You can go to Target or anywhere and buy those little rectangular batteries. Two wires. They just touch it like that, and they destroy it in their parking lot. It's pretty exciting. We normally do it at lunchtime, you know, when the mechanics are on a break. But it is that simple. My impression is that the most complicated thing would be to get the airbag inflator assembly out of the vehicle in order to deploy it, if that is the route that's taken. The simplest of all would be to try to deploy it and all the airbags in situ in the vehicle. But I don't know how practical that is. I don't know what the wiring is like underneath the hood.
Okay. I'd like to bring Mr. Cosgrove up just briefly. He is under time pressure, and then we'll have time for more questions as needed.
Okay.
You left you holding the bag.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, Paul Cosgrove and I represent the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. We have an environmental expert that was unable to come to the hearing today, and he'd be glad to come if the committee takes this issue up again at a future time. But I can report that, as the professor and Representative Greenlake have mentioned, the issue is being worked on by the industry internationally. There is an ISO, International Standards Organization, work group that was formed some time ago. It is a tri-continent work group, meaning the meetings are sometimes in Europe, sometimes in North America. The next one, which I understand is later this month, is in Japan, where they're trying to work on standards for tooling and other changes to make deployment of end-of-life airbags simple, predictable, and safe for dismantlers, for car recyclers. As an industry, we do have some concerns about recycling airbags for the reasons that were mentioned. In fact, we passed legislation in Oregon about 4 years ago to make it a crime to reinstall a deployed airbag. Now, that's different from an undeployed airbag, but some of the same safety concerns existed with people who were trying to put the bag back in and put new bag material and sort of remanufacture them. And of course, the safety issues are a great concern to us. We have similar concerns about recycled airbags for safety reasons. But as has been mentioned, the simple way to handle this problem is deployment at end of life. And we are working on trying to get international agreement on engineering specifications to make that possible with all the recyclers around the nation, in fact, around the world, who have to deal with this, and with all the manufacturers around the world who make these different cars. I'd be glad to answer the questions that I can, but I may have to defer to my expert if the questions are too detailed. Thank you very much, Mr. Okay. Chairman.
Thank you very much.
Representative Greenlake just asked me, is that standard going forward for future cars? It's a standard for a tool that is hopefully going to be able to be used for existing automobiles and manufacturing, as I understand, manufacturing specifications for new cars going forward. It's both retro and prospective, as I understand it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I've asked Mr. Cosgrove to go to the speaker and have me named as a representative to that tricontinental
committee, but he hasn't agreed to do that yet.
Mr. Speaker, I've asked for the next meeting to be in Barcelona, and I'm going.
I was wondering at the beginning of your testimony if possibly Representative Greenlake was on a junket to Tucson. He has several trips down there to find out more about sodium azide.
I would say, just as Professor Betterton has paid his own way to get here, I paid my own way to get to Tucson.
There are many who would like to see you leave town.
A committee, perhaps a committee trip.
Representative Barnard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're aware of the reality that sometimes standards development takes a long time. Do we have any sense what the time frame is likely to be on this one?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, I do not personally know. I know that the materials that I was able to find and supplied to Representative Greenlake, and it's only a part of the answer, reflects that a whole series of decisions were going to be made by the end of December for rollout and agreement at this meeting in later in March, I believe. It is a complicated process because we're dealing with manufacturers worldwide, and they're all at the table, and that's a lot of different people with a lot of different engineers. But I don't believe we're terribly far off, but I can't say that for certain. I think the person I'm able to bring, if we have another hearing or even if not, to work on this process outside the hearing process, would have the exact answer on that. He's been monitoring and participating in that work group.
Thank you.
Thank you. Could you relate the dangerousness, obviously 45,000 canisters, if all exploded at once would be dangerous, but is there really a danger? It seems like if you just push a little button and ignite one, it's relatively harmless. Where's the major danger?
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. If you stand back 10 feet from one of these airbag inflators when you connect the wires, it goes off. It sounds like a bomb. and the inflator module gets very hot. I know that. I try to pick one up immediately after it went off. But that's the extent of it. As long as you're not right in the immediate vicinity, you're safe. And there's very little, if any, azide, residual azide released in that smoke that you see there.
Mr. Chairman, I just learned, though, one of the reasons it requires some work is the new BMW 7 Series evidently has 7 different airbags. Mm-hmm. And so it needs to be a process where there's materials available for recyclers to know all the different installations and how to fire them all and make sure they do fire them all. They're not just in steering wheels or dashboards anymore. They're inside curtains and all the other things. Now, some of those newer ones may not have sodium azide, but nonetheless, the safest thing in our belief is to have them all deployed, because you may not know what's in them, and it's safer just to have them all deployed at recycling.
Is there a danger in a car fire?
Mr. Chairman, I get emails from, even from England, firefighting organizations. They're worried about that, an airbag going off inadvertently during the fire, or even if the vehicle is not on fire, a first responder may, for example, lean in to extract an occupant, and the bag may go off and inadvertently strike the person in the wrong angle and cause them some injury. So the first responders, the emergency responders, are concerned about airbags, and there are written instructions for how to deal with that in an emergency.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Greeley. We call Dr. Dave Stone from the Department of Human Services.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Dave Stone. I'm an environmental toxicologist with the Office of Public Health Systems in the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to talk about House Bill 2507 and the public health implications of sodium azide. As Dr. Betterton and Representative Greenlick alluded to, sodium azide is a potentially dangerous chemical. It has an exceedingly high toxicity based on animal tests and, in some cases, some intentional and accidental poisonings. I won't go over the electrical discharge and the airbag inflation that goes on, since Dr. Betterton did such a good job of that. But essentially, once the airbag is deployed, as we've heard, sodium azide is burned up and combusted and no longer a threat. It's also used as a preservative in hospital and laboratory settings, and it has had a lot of agricultural use in the past and has continued to be used in some industrial processes. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta has reported poisonings with this chemical, and most of these are actually in the clinical and laboratory setting. There's a lot of uncertainty about environmental exposures due to operations such as car recycling or disassembly events. But I can tell you that the majority of the fatalities that have occurred as a result of sodium azide exposure have occurred because of ingestion, be that intentional or accidental. House Bill 2507 will require that DHS provide support staff to a newly formed task force. And this task force would be studying the risks posed by potential releases to sodium azide, especially in the car shredding and fluffing operations. DHS is very supportive of this further research and analysis regarding the public health threat and the environmental releases of sodium azide. If passed, House Bill 2507 would have an expected fiscal impact, and DHS would be required to support staff to the task force. This fiscal impact is not part of the governor's recommended budget, and the department is maintaining a neutral bill into position. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Yes. Questions? Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You were here during the earlier testimony. The amounts that are used in the labs is tiny, isn't it, compared to what we've heard being used in airbag manufacture?
Chair Anderson, Representative Barnhart, I suppose it would depend on the application in the lab. I honestly don't know what volumes. If you're doing research on it, I imagine you could be using a lot more than someone who was using it for a preservative in a cell counting. But I do know that there are stocks of it in some healthcare settings. I talked with Oregon Poison Control about this, and the reason that there are intentional deaths is some people use it for suicide because it's found in large amounts and they know it works.
Thank you.
Staff like to explain the, or would you like to explain the Department of Human Services impact statement?
Chair Anderson, I don't think I'd be best qualified to explain the fiscal impact.
Chair?
Yes.
I'm certainly not going to profess to have any expertise in explaining this, but I certainly would suggest to the chair that I have some expertise about questioning the amount that they're asking for here as far as, or that they're suggesting here. I mean, $18,000 for a person coming out of general fund, that seems to, for a task force, seems to me to be a pretty generously paid staffing of that. And $28,000 for services and supplies would also, for a task force, seem to be pretty generous amount of. That's a lot of paper clips, I guess I'm suggesting, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right. Any questions, Dr. Stone?
Thank you, Clark. All right.
Thank you very much for coming and joining us. If we will expect to hear from Mr. Cosgrove's expert, and hopefully down the line we'll be able to work this path. So I will close the public hearing.
May I?
Yes.
And I don't know what the chair's intention of what we plan to do with this. That's another item. But I do question the fiscal that's being presented here to us. And if it were to pass, it would go to legislative. We would be able to get a fiscal from legislative fiscal, which would give
hopefully
us
quite a bit less.
Yeah, which would give us a determination of whether it fell into where it fell on this. So that's just kind of observation at this particular point.
But okay, very good. All right, I will close the public hearing. And seeing no other business on the agenda, I'll close the meeting. We are adjourned.